first media briefing podcast of the new year.
So welcome to 2017, everybody.
I am Chris Sutcliffe, I'm the news editor for the media briefing.
And I'm Esther Kazai, I'm the digital content executive.
Later this episode, we're going to be hearing from Vanessa Quirk. She's the web editor of Metropolis magazine in a bit of a meta podcast about podcasts. But before then, we're going to jump straight back into the news because of my first podcast of the new year, a lot's been happening.
Really good bit of news, first off, is that Metal Hammer magazine have been saved from closure. So this was the pre-Christmas news that Team Rock went into administration. It was, 2 weeks before Christmas?
Yeah. I was going to say, this isn't good news for Team Rock. This is good news for everybody else, though.
Yes.
It's particularly good news for Future, who have bought back these brands for, £800,000.
And they sold them for £10.2 million.
That is the bargain of the century. I cannot imagine. I would love to be a fly on the wall of that meeting. Are they really going to get away with doing this?
It's good news in the sense that Future obviously see a future for these magazines, however they may have conducted the deal. So they've picked up Team Rock's classic magazines, websites and events, including the 30-year-old Metal Hammer title.
It's interesting. I was talking to our editor, Peter Houston, the other day, and he's you know, very well versed in magazines, and particularly in the acquisition of magazines. And I was putting to him, you know, this idea that, oh, they might well go digital only with a lot of these titles. And he was saying, yeah, that might make sense, but at the same time, these magazines are almost exclusively monetized by the 50-year-old British men who buy these magazines, who are, you know, particularly interested in heavy metal and, you know, and rock. So if they do go digital only with a couple of them, they're going to have to really think about how they appeal to a new audience.
Yeah. They are quite niche, but, you know, the Metal Hammer magazine at the moment is, it's got a circulation of about 20,000 copies a month.
It's not bad. No.
Okay. Let's not do that again.
It could be worse, but at the same time, you do have to think Future has a plan for these brands. In, I guess, slightly less good news on the face of it, but maybe, you know, with interesting
good news for some, not so good for others.
Yeah, interesting implications for the future of media, at least. Medium wants to move away from ad-supported content. You know, it's described that business model, which is almost entirely dependent on clicks and views, as a broken system. And he's talking about the entire sort of ad-based ecosystem of the internet. It's a big statement.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote some quite strong words about how, you know, this ad-funded system, it was a race to the bottom in terms of quality. So they basically said they're going to work on a new business model.
So he was very specific about ads being a broken system. He was less specific about what this new model will look like.
Yeah, you know, he quoted, it's too soon to say exactly what this will look like. Well, when he finds the answer, I think we're all behind him to find out what that is. Yeah.
And this transition came at a bad time for a couple of publishers, because obviously with an increasing number migrating across exclusively to Medium, to suddenly hear, oh, actually the business model is broken, must have been a really sort of unhappy Christmas for them.
Yeah, and there are around 50 publishers that were looking to move all their stuff exclusively to Medium, Exit One Basket.
Mm.
Like the establishment found out at the same time as everybody else did about this move, and you think there's definitely been a breakdown in communication there somewhere.
Absolutely. And it's worth noting, I think, that Medium is still a very vital and significant force in digital publishing. I mean, it's raised more than $130 million from, you know, a number of well-known investors, Andreessen Horowitz, Google Ventures, Greylock, Spark Capital, and its most recent funding round valued the company at more than $600 million.
And I think there's a spark of hope here, because if anybody can find the answer, it's this kind of quite agile company who... they've
more agile than ever now.
Yeah, they've got almost the entire media world ahead of them to experiment with, and they've got the money and they've got the name behind them. It's not like some others which have had to start from scratch. Is this going to be a case of if they can't do it, nobody can?
Yeah, it's possible, but at the same time, I feel like there is a growing sentiment that ad-based business models aren't necessarily going to work for everybody. I don't want to say, you know, as a blanket statement, Tom Standage from The Economist mentioned the other day that he sees banner advertising, well, display advertising in particular, he sees it disappearing entirely by 2025.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's under a decade away, as scary as that sounds. You know, China has plans to be on Mars by 2020, so the fact that he thinks that, you know, even 5 years after that, basically the entire funding model of the internet will have disappeared by that time is, I think, is significant. I mean, it's significant, again, that Medium has taken the first steps towards finding another way around that.
Yeah, so after Medium's post, Digiday actually launched a counterattack, and they said that the ad-funded model can work well if it's done properly. And they presented the argument that actually, if it wasn't working, it's not the model's fault, it's the company implementing it. And I think that my favourite quote from them
that
was,
is a great phrase.
Like democracy, advertising for many companies is the least worst model.
Do we want to be aiming for least worst? I mean, obviously you want subscriptions and you want subscriptions to grow because it's a regular source of income and you can plan ahead with that. Least worst?
I think it's sustainability though, and everybody, however well the model is working for you now, knows that 10, 20, 30 years down the line, the ad funding model is not sustainable.
Certainly. And even with all the investment into, I mean, you've seen the investment we've had into programmatic teams in the UK and particularly in the US. So it's not going away anytime soon in terms of, and people are going to continue to develop how they buy, how they sell, you know, how they measure the effectiveness of an ad. It's not going away anytime soon, but yeah, people are starting to ask questions about it. Suddenly the foundations look a little bit more shaky.
Well, it's almost like the better the technology gets at figuring out how people interact, the more they realise people don't.
Yeah, and speaking of lack of interaction then, Snapchat's been accused of faking growth numbers.
Yeah, this is one of the stories that if it's found out to be true, Snapchat are going to be in a lot of trouble. So there's a former Snapchat employee who had been there about 3 weeks and was fired after that from Facebook. He was allegedly raising concerns about the metrics, and when he said to the company, you know, you should look at correctly there, as they booted him.
Yeah, and not only that, he was alleging that they shared these deliberately inflated metrics rather with some investors in attempts to sort of bolster a standing ahead of that initial IPO.
And the IPO could go ahead as early as March.
Yeah.
So yeah, Snapchat allegedly have around 150 million daily active users. You know, we always see numbers in the millions, the billions of video views. We see these huge numbers coming out of Snapchat, and so far, very few people kind of question that.
Yeah. Is, yeah, that almost for publishers in particular, those who exist on Snapchat Discover to place their faith in this company and suddenly to find out, oh, maybe the rug's been pulled out from underneath them. But again, that's not how Snapchat necessarily makes its money. That it makes its money through, you know, repurposing of its existing user base. And if that turns out to have been inflated, then that does raise questions about, well, it's not only its long-term viability, but, you know, why should anybody trust anything they say in the future? Now, to be fair, this is one guy. This isn't like...
Yes,
this
and Snapchat, I said, well, obviously this lawsuit's come from a completely disgruntled former employee. Like, there is... No evidence.
What do you have to do... Say that he wasn't pushed out because he discovered, you know, he found a smoking gun. What do you have to do to be fired from a job in 3 weeks?
Well,
do you just have to not turn up for a fortnight?
He was hired from Facebook, and they'd apparently hired him in order... Well, he said that they'd hired him and then pumped information about how Facebook worked, which he couldn't divulge because...
Yeah. Well, of course, it's an NBA, yeah.
So when they... His story is that when they realised they couldn't get anything out of him, they fired him.
Right. Still, I mean...
The plot thickens.
It does, and this is significant because there are huge figures involved, not just in terms of these allegedly artificially inflated user numbers, but Snapchat could raise as much as $4 billion in its upcoming IPO.
Yeah.
It's not a small amount of money.
It wouldn't be surprising. I mean, they would just join Facebook and Twitter, who've also been caught inflating metrics.
Yeah, and what was interesting is that it wasn't necessarily that they were caught, it was that they sort of said, actually, that was the disclosure that they made. They went, actually, we've been making a mistake here. Hands up, I feel a little bit bad for piling in so hard on Facebook about that, because Twitter was immediately, I know, because Facebook, rather Twitter was immediately like, actually, you know, sometimes we've been doing it with video as well. So it does kind of feel like, do we allow the companies like this to make honest mistakes and come clean with it?
I think it's that thing, isn't it, that they're getting ready to float the company.
Anyway,
in other surprising print news, BuzzFeed have made headlines for non-digital reasons. They launched a cookbook which has sold more than 100,000 copies in under 2 months, which if it was a traditional publisher would shoot it to about a third in the best-selling list for the Christmas period.
It's, you know, it's an extension of what they've been doing already with e-commerce. You know, they are heavily investing in it. They see it almost as being a significant revenue stream going forward. And this really does, as you mentioned here, it highlights how new technology lets authors, particularly those with enormous scale, bypass this traditional model of book publishing, where you sort of had to go to an agent, you had to demonstrate the validity of this, of your idea. And it's sort of gone, in fact, we don't have to do it like that anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, BuzzFeed haven't given any final figures on those yet, but given the price that they sell these books at, sales are probably between $2.4 and $3.9 million.
Chump change.
I don't bother
getting out of bed for less than 500 million. When I started doing my journalism course, my MA, we had to sit down, and it was part of a this exercise in memory and being able to speak fluently for 2 minutes straight, you know, filibustering almost. And we had to pick a subject that you could talk on for 2 minutes without pausing, without repetition. And I chose the cartoon Futurama because I think that's like a fantastic show, but also I felt like this is something that over the course of years I've come to know intimately. Is there anything that you would say?
I think mine would be musical theatre, but nobody wants to hear about that for 2 minutes. Unless I sing, but yeah, let's not do that.
One of the next podcasts maybe. But there's very few topics that you can that people can conclusively claim to know that intimately. You know, people build careers off it. Which is why events like our upcoming digital media strategies are so valuable to all the attendees and even all the speakers. You know, we have speakers from a vast array of companies coming from all sides of the media industry who just really want to share that expertise so that everyone can at least have a slightly more holistic view of what's happening in the industry. I mean, we're not claiming that this is going to make you an instant expert on the media industry. Nobody can claim that.
No, but it'll make you an expert over 3 days.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's one of those things that we really hope that you come away with a much greater knowledge of the media industry that you can sort of put into practice at your own companies that you can really use to develop your own strategies going forward. So that's more information is available at digital-media-strategies.com. And listen to the end of the podcast, for we have a number of deals going on at the moment.
Yeah, because it's early bird, ends this week, so get on it.
Now we're going to hear from Vanessa Quirk. She is now the web editor for Metropolis magazine in New York. But when I first heard her speak at Gen Summit in Vienna, she had just completed a research project on podcasts for the Tau Center. And so I was really interested to get her on this podcast just to talk about what is the future of the medium. You know, what did she learn over the course of doing all that research, and how can publishers really get involved? And so when I heard you speak in Vienna, you mentioned that there was this perception that podcasts as a medium had been almost simmering until around 2014, and then they sort of really took off. But you mentioned at the time that that wasn't necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of people pointed to Serial as a takeoff moment, but anyone that was paying attention before Serial kind of knew that podcasting had begun, I mean, a decade beforehand. And so it had been kind of slowly growing over time. And I think what Serial did was just kind of increase awareness. And I would say at this point also kind of interest in on the advertising side. But the reason why I didn't take off before that was because just technically it was too kind of cumbersome and clunky to easily download podcasts. It wasn't until about a month or two before Serial came out that it was actually quite easy to kind of seamlessly stream on your phone, because there was the native podcast app on your iPhone. And at least in the US market, iPhone is the predominant device that people use to listen to podcasts. So the Serial kind of coincided with the technical upgrades that allowed it to take off. But if it hadn't been for that kind of improvement in the technical capability, it probably wouldn't have been able to kind of spread around as it did.
No, exactly. It's interesting that, you know, media consumption is going so increasingly mobile first, or even mobile only. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels like podcasts were the first one that were, you know, this is a medium that is made for mobile. And it feels like now a lot of publishers are sort of recognizing that that's where people are spending their time. And they're almost jumping headfirst into this idea that people listen to, you know, many more podcasts purely because it is almost the first truly mobile native medium. Was that something you came across in your research?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the fact that it is a mobile medium makes it very interesting. It means that there is a huge audience just waiting to be tapped into, because mobile consumption, even on the visual side, we see that kind of steadily on the increase, and podcasts are perfectly suited to mobile consumption much more than any other way of listening to them. I mean, you could stream on a desktop, but it makes more sense to stream, listen on the go. It's one of these mediums that you often do as you're doing something else.
No, certainly. I mean, that has been one of the few benefits of the recent tube strikes in London, that I could listen to so many more of my podcasts. You know, it's almost like I subscribe to so many now that I genuinely don't have enough hours in the day to listen to them all. It's almost a triage situation.
So right.
What would it take then to really improve these metrics to the point where, you know, podcast advertising becomes a recognized and sort of mature form of advertising?
Well, it's tricky because, Apple is such a huge player in the space. I mean, they are, I mean, every success that podcasting has had so far, you can kind of, not to take away from any creators, but you can kind of lay it at the feet of Apple because of the podcast app and making it a native app. And so they are a huge force in the podcasting space technologically. But for them, if you look at it from their perspective, podcasting is just a drop in the bucket of the many, many things that they do, which probably bring them far, far more, much more revenue. So it would be very helpful if Apple did take a stand and made it more made podcasts more searchable, easier to share. If they provided better analytics for content creators as they upload their podcasts. And they obviously have the technological capabilities to do it. And then that makes it difficult because obviously who's going to be a technological challenger to Apple? So there are a couple that are trying and are trying to enter the space, but of course it's kind of fraught because should Apple ever decide to enter, then, well, maybe they'll get bought out or they could just get, you know, clobbered. So, I mean, Acast is an interesting network that's been attempting to improve the metrics, and they have a few developers that moved over from Spotify, and they're trying to kind of apply that algorithmic technology to podcasts. And there are a bunch of other technology players that are kind of making steps and waves, and with Facebook Audio now too. I mean, obviously that's not, I don't know how to what extent Facebook is going to be more open than Apple and giving you analytics and everything. But, I mean, there's movement happening. I don't know what it will take exactly for it to become, well, more sophisticated. I would say probably just more money if more advertisers continue to buy in.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that's exactly right with this idea that because it's such an opt-in medium, these you know, listeners have such a direct relationship with the people who are producing these podcasts. So, I mean, is that direct relationship going to be central to this, to podcast advertising going forward?
Yeah, and not just advertising, but also subscribing. I mean, most podcasts right now are free. They have this free model, and then you listen to the advertising, and you purchase, and that's essentially the price you pay for getting free content. But I think as podcasts progress, I think we're going to see new revenue streams and models, more subscription options. Certain podcasts are already experimenting with kind of tiered content structures where the first general tier is free, and then if you'll get extra content or more special content if you opt in and pay an extra something. Events and like special kind of membership type models are also kind of emerging where people are paying for the service directly. And I think that speaks to the same thing that you were getting to earlier about you feel like you know the hosts and you want to support them. And I think that's an unusual thing in this day and age. And I'm sure it's quite different. It might be quite different in the UK where you have the BBC and you have this kind of expectation of getting your media for free or via taxes. But in the US at least, there is a kind of a tradition of having to support your nonprofit entertainment via your own private donation, right? So they've been fairly successful at tapping into that. Obviously, it's hard as more podcasts emerge because you need to fight for audiences, but it's still at the stage. It's still early enough, I'd say, that podcasts are really helping each other to grow the audience overall.
It's actually astonishing how fast I became. I got an Amazon Dot for Christmas, and it was astonishing how fast I became just habituated to waking up and saying, Alexa, what's my flash briefing? And just getting my news that way. So yeah, I can see she's just gone for it.
See?
Yeah. Alexa, stop. Okay, that's terrifying. But yeah, you mentioned earlier this monetization potential outside of traditional advertising. When you were doing your research, was branded podcasting, you know, much of a thing at that point? I'm thinking of things like The Message, which obviously GE had a hand in.
Yep. I mean, the message had been out for a bit. And I think I've at least been seeing more of that emerging since the proposal, or what am I calling it? The white paper, whatever it's called. Yeah. my research study came out. And so I think that that's just going to happen more and more. I think the podcasting world is following the general media world in that way. And obviously it's a tricky road to walk for both podcasting and just mainstream media, if you will. But it's happening. I mean, Gimlet Creative is doing a lot of interesting kind of branded stuff. And I would not be surprised if we just see more and more of it in the future. Well, there's two different types of branded podcasts too. There's the kind which is like the message where all you get is brand alignment. So GE says, we are aligned with this really interesting, cool project. Aren't we cool, like by proxy? And then there's the other kind, which is much more invested in kind of creating stories out of the sponsor itself. So I think with Gimlet Creative, they have that Tinder related podcast where it's about dating.
Yeah.
And it's sponsored by Tinder. But it's very much about like improving your Tinder profile. And so there's kind of like two ways that you can go around. I mean, more than two, but there's multiple ways to kind of tackle this issue. It's just, how do you leverage sponsorship and the revenue that you get from that without alienating your audience? That's obviously the central question, not just for podcasts.
But at the same time, I remember reading, you did an article with, I think it was Media Shift, an interview rather, where you mentioned that, yeah, monetization it's fantastic, but one of the great strengths of podcasting is that it fosters this direct relationship between the sort of the brand or the, you know, it fosters this engagement almost. So is that really sort of, should that be where publishers are putting their money at the moment? This idea that they can build up a relationship rather than a direct sort of monetization thing at the moment?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on your revenue streams, right? I mean, if you are entirely dependent on advertising, then you're probably going to be chasing traffic and you're going to be chasing impressions. And I would say it's very unlikely that via a podcast you're going to accumulate the kind of impressions that you need to satisfy whatever bottom line you need to get for advertisers. But if you as a media company are looking to kind of perhaps fill in niche group, like really speak to some sort of demographic and connect with them and leverage that connection in potentially a long-term type of relationship that involves kind of a type of a subscription or a membership model, then podcasting becomes a very it's perfectly suited towards that kind of revenue stream. So I think you have to be careful. And I mean, podcasting isn't as high an investment as, say, video is, like the initial capital. But if you want to do it properly, you need to be consistent, right? And you need to build a relationship. I think consistency is the number one, and quality is also number one. Let's say quality is number one, consistency is number two.
Two number ones.
Actually, let's reverse that. But if you have the resources for that, then you have the potential to really grow an audience. And it's kind of more of a slow game, but it has the potential to really make a difference. And really, like when it comes to brand awareness and building a brand, I think it has a lot of potential.
And so when you spoke in at Gen Summit in Vienna, you mentioned this idea that podcasting has been growing steadily over the last, X number of years, not necessarily since 2014, but beyond that. You know, are we on track to see that growth continue over the next couple of years, or is there almost a plateau?
I haven't seen, I'd have to look at the numbers more recently to see what came out, to see if there has been a spike or anything since I last wrote the report, but I don't think we've hit the plateau yet. What's definitely interesting is the different types of podcasts that have been coming out. So, fiction podcasts are kind of having a moment, or they will be having a moment. I think we've definitely seen those on the rise.
Yeah.
Which in the US is just crazy, because I know in the UK there's more of a tradition of fiction radio, but in the US we haven't had that since the 1930s practically. So that's really interesting that's back on the rise. But I don't think we've seen the plateau yet, because the numbers are still pretty lowball, especially when you compare them to radio. I mean, radio has an extremely large number of listeners, and podcasting is still a tiny sliver of that. So if we assume that everyone with ears who listens to the radio is a potential podcast listener, then we are not anywhere near the plateau. So I think a lot of the research I did a few years ago was that it will take connected cars to really hit the market in the kind of a tipping point number for podcasting to take off, because you'll have the radio option, but you'll also have the connected car connected to your phone stream. And that might be the kind of context that we need for podcasting to take off more.
Definitely. At that point, does it almost become indistinguishable from, you know, we spoke of it before, almost this blanket term of audio. At that point, does podcasting just become audio in the same way that radio is? You know, whether,
I mean,
whether it's
I
a
think,
sort of pick and mix.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see, does podcasting become a more passive medium? Does it merge with radio in that way? I hope it doesn't, because, I mean, who knows what will happen, but I kind of hope it doesn't, because I think there's so much more work to be done on the content side. When you conceptualize of podcasts as an opt-in, engage medium. Because what radio reporters have learned from day one is, say your point clearly, say it fast, say it kind of repeat your message, because people aren't really listening, and which is why I actually love radio, writing for radio, which sounds bizarre, but it's very clear and conversational, and usually very concise. I don't think that shouldn't translate to podcasting in the content creation, but there's so much room for kind of ambiance and drama and sound design, and almost kind of merging with kind of film techniques. So I think there's a lot of room for podcasting to grow as its own medium, because it's opt-in and in your earbuds rather than kind of out in the radio waves.
We like to ask all our sort of regular interviewees and our regular guests, what was the last thing that you read, the last sort of book that really affected you, that really made you, you know, think about, you know, whatever, just that sort of really sparked an emotional reaction in you?
Can I say a podcast?
Absolutely, yeah.
On the nose?
Yeah, no, go for it.
Let's see. There's a couple that come to mind. A friend of mine does this podcast called The Intern, which is a first-person narrative about her entering, coming from the nonprofit world and entering the tech world, and her being kind of like a fish out of water. And I think she'd admit, like, some episodes are better than others, but there's one episode that is really tremendous, which is, I can't remember the name of the episode, but it's the episode where she asks for a raise, and she chronicles the journey of her, like, psyching herself up, like, today I'm gonna ask for a raise, like, I'm gonna go in there, and then she records the actual meeting where she talks to her boss and asks for the raise, and it is the most intense 10 seconds, but it feels like an eternity, and your just heart's just racing because everyone's been there. And she kind of goes through like all the hurdles, and especially for young women, asking for money is always kind of a challenge. So I really liked the way she approached it. She kind of got all sides of the issue, and you're really with her and you want to know how it turns out.
So in addition to our events, in addition to our podcast, and in addition to our many articles that go up over the course of the week, we also publish a daily newsletter, which contains an essential daily briefing, plus our roundup of the most interesting media articles from around the web. You can sign up to that on our site, themediabriefing.com, or we actually have a link in most of our articles.
And we've also got, as we mentioned earlier, Digital Media Strategies, which is coming up. That's the 20th to the 23rd of February in London. This kind of very much takes the philosophy that we try and take on everything. It's not about what's instantly happening, it's about what that means for you. And the most important thing is that the early bird expires this Friday, the 13th of January, and only full price tickets are available after that. So it's like, now is your time to snatch up that bargain. We've got our attendee list online. There are a lot of people in the C section. CEO, CTO, CMO, C...
Anything that starts with C, we have.
How many letters can you put in C? this is like a really top-level senior event. And we're also holding the British Media Awards shortlist party at Digital Media Strategies, so it's another great reason to attend.
Absolutely.
Digital-media-strategies.com.
And speaking of the British Media Awards, the entries are now open for the 2017 British Media Awards, which take place on the 3rd of May. The judging panel and categories have now been announced at britishmediaawards.com, and the entries close on the 27th of January.
That's not far
it's
off.
Not long off, so you better get started on your entries now.
And finally, as of last year, we make this podcast for you. So if you've got anything you want to hear, any guests you want on, or if there's anything you like, dislike, want us to talk about, or want us to shut up about, please get in touch.
Right. And we can be found on Twitter. I'm at Chris M. Sutcliffe.
And I'm at Esther Keziah H.
And we can both be found at Media Brief. So we'll be back next week. Have a fantastic week and we'll see you then.
Bye.